You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and today I have in the studio David Reif, the author of Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World, as the guest today on Bookworm. You were mentioning before we started that less than prognostication or social science, that this had been written, Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World, published by Simon & Schuster, as a work of literature. What did you mean?
Well, I suppose to some extent I am proudest of the form of this book. I think it's what it is. I hope it succeeds, but I think what it is a kind of prolonged meditation on what Los Angeles is all about, which is a very different thing from wanting to write a public policy book or either a hagiographical account of or a rabid denunciation of Los Angeles. And my models, to the extent that I have any, I suppose I should add the usual disclaimer about how, you know, all credit goes to them, all fault lies with me. But I mean, the people whose work I modeled myself on as a writer, a travel writer, if you like, are the V.S. Naipaul, his brother Shiva, Joan Didion, Chatwin. And obviously, to me, the interest of those books is their writing. I don't think that I read India, Wounded Civilization, a book I have so many copies of and accompanies me almost everywhere, because I'm interested in what Mrs. Gandhi did during the emergency when Vidya Naipaul went to India. I'm interested in it as if you like, a work of literature. And what I wanted to write was a meditation on America, using L.A. as a kind of paradigm. As we were also saying before the program, you're the first person to notice the subtext of the title, which of course is the book that Walter Benjamin wanted to write and never actually finished. There are only notes for it, which was called Paris, Capital of the 19th Century.
Thank God there are those notes. You know, some of the most inspiring jottings that have ever existed anywhere. I wondered then, you know, in such a book, and let's open up the subject a little bit larger, it seems to me that what's interesting about Benjamin and his notes about Baudelaire and Paris, what's interesting, too, about, say, Roland Barthes or Foucault, is that they are interesting. They are more interesting for their abilities as raconteurs and thinkers than as theorists and methodologists, i.e., I guess, the obligation seems to be simply to be brilliant, not necessarily to be truthful. Would you agree with that?
Well, I certainly agree with it in the case of Foucault, who I think actually manages to say a lot of wrong things absolutely brilliantly. I mean, these books are invaluable goads to thinking. When you start taking them apart, particularly the ones with sweeping historical claims, they don't stand up very well. I certainly agree with that about Barthes, of course, who was, to me, or to my mind, the work of Barthes that I like and care about still, is the littérateur's work, the lover's discourse about the book on the camera lucida about the...
I like the autobiography myself very, very much.
Yes, that too, sure. So, yeah, the obligation is to be brilliant. I mean, all writing that's not absolutely instrumental, that isn't simply an account of, I don't know what, take at random, the auto industry and its decline, example of a recent bestseller, the madness on Wall Street of the 80s. I mean, those books might be very suggestive to read, and often are, but But obviously, a book that isn't going to claim this overall, to give you some very specific bit of information, must depend on simply being worth reading in a very different sense, and being worth reading because you'd like to spend however long it takes you to read 100,000 words with that person, that author, that person's idea. It's about the world interest you. You don't have to agree with them. I, for example, don't agree with Foucault, and yet I think I've read every line.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why when I was looking through a kind of outraged review of Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World, in the Los Angeles Times book review by Michael Ventura, I found that his objections, well, no one I know has a maid, well, most people I know live in apartments, were not necessarily relevant and based upon perhaps a misunderstanding of what subjectivity is.
Well, I thought it was a misunderstanding of what subjectivity is, and perhaps also a very peculiar to me, to my mind at least, idea of what information is. Ventura complains very bitterly that I'm an outsider. I mean, if there's anything I'm proud of, it's being an outsider. Indeed, if there's one place that I think I couldn't write about, it's New York, where I live. I think that that's precisely what a travel writer is. And if Ventura wants to indict us all as a kind of species, fair enough. But if we're talking about what the nature of travel writing, political travel writing, cultural travel writing is, it's about going someplace alien to you. That's the whole point of the exercise. The point of, I think, for example, that I can't write about New York for the simple reason that when, say, I go into a coffee shop in L.A., I want to know who the busboy is, and I want to know why the decor is the way it is, and I want to know lots of detail. I'm curious. But if I do it in the same act in New York, if I perform the same act in New York, I just want a cup of coffee. I live there. I'm getting on with my life. Whereas the whole fun and the whole challenge of writing the kinds of books that I write is about turning up somewhere and trying to sort it out. That said, of course it's subjective. I want to use Los Angeles as a paradigm for talking about certain things going on in America and certain things going on in the world. Most importantly, I want to talk about what it is, what the de-Europeanization of the United States feels like. And of course, the examples of people who live in, say, Michael Ventura's, well, I don't know him, so it's perhaps not fair to pick on, of people who don't live this way, really doesn't matter much to me one way or the other. I never said, except perhaps in moments of hyperbole, that absolutely everybody in Los Angeles lives with a maid and a gardener. I said that a whole world that 30 years ago didn't have maids and gardeners now have them. I also gave more reasons than simply engulfment by aliens. I, among other things, I said that white American men, again, there are many exceptions, but the norm, the middle class norm, was indeed to have a servant. That servant was called a wife. And that one of the interests of what's gone on is that almost this new immigrant-dependent America, not just Los Angeles, but America, urban America, urban middle class America, to be very specific, is one of the reasons it is the way it is as, if you like, an unintended result of feminism. People, the wife servants went out into the workplace and
leading to a new kind of imperialism.
Yes, in a way, it did.
There is the question of what kind of person visits foreign places and stays to some extent apart from them. It interested me this morning, I was thinking in that regard, that Dwight MacDonald's son, Nick, had done a book about American cities. And I wondered whether there might not be some impulse, since you too are the son of an American critic and thinker, to go to a place to write about something non-mental.
It's an interesting thought. An American writer once said of me that he comes from an intellectual somewhere but a geographic nowhere. The writer in question was Philip Roth. I think perhaps Philip is more rooted in his geographic somewhere than many American writers have been, and so perhaps he has a slightly extreme sense of that. But I know what he means, and I absolutely accept that. Look, probably for biographical reasons. Sometimes when people say, where were you born, I say, in the faculty club. And there is some truth to that. I mean, the faculty club of UCLA, of the University of California at Berkeley, at Harvard, those places are actually much more real to me in sense of childhood than perhaps the normal childhood of Americans. And I've mined this childhood for a lot of what I do. The Miami book that I wrote was very much undergirded by the fact that as a 7- and 8-year-old in New York, I'd been surrounded by these gay Cuban writer exiles who were my mother's friends in New York in the early 60s. And so that speech, those metaphors, that florid style was practically imprinted on my neurons. And so when I came to write a book about Miami, ostensibly about Cuban Americans and immigration and this and that, of course, these memories of my gay uncles and was always there. And I think that it's true that the children of writers, of particularly the children, I think, of well-known writers, have a kind of peculiar rootlessness. They often do, anyway, particularly if they follow in their parent writers' footsteps and become writers themselves. I suppose it's different if one becomes a lawyer or something, but neither Nick McDonald nor I did.
It's sort of interesting because I'm personally very fond of the rhythms of Maria Irene Fornes, really one of my favorite playwrights, and I hadn't thought about that in relation to the Miami book that you had. A native speaker.
Fifu and Her Friends was written in the living room.
What a lucky place.
But I think that, books always have subtexts, and I think that the reason I write about aliens, I think the reason that I'm so interested in these questions of immigration and ethnic transformation and identity, generally cultural identity, is precisely because I've always felt rather a tenuous grip on any of them, any of the various identities to which I could lay claim. I hope not simply for the traditional Groucho Marx reason that one wouldn't want to belong to any club that would have one for a member, but maybe a bit of that. But more importantly, I think the sense of identity being, first of all, fractured, and second of all, always up for grabs. And so, in a sense, for me at least, the immigration, which in a sense poses what are quite private psychobiographical problems in large cultural and political arenas, is a natural subject for me, I expect.
One of the ways in which Los Angeles has taught this particular transposed Easterner to speak is in certain imperatives, and one such might be the sentence, well, New York is over. What might that mean?
Well, Los Angeles is very keen on hierarchy. Los Angeles is a place, the only other place I know of that's as keen on hierarchy as Los Angeles, apart from the American military, of course, is Japan. There is a constant chatter, I find, in Los Angeles, prosperous Los Angeles. I must be careful now about my generalizations. As there is in prosperous Japan, about what's number one. And I think perhaps because of the old and rather tedious feud between New York and L.A., there's a great deal of gleeful thinking in Los Angeles at the moment, occasioned by all the bad news from New York, that New York is no longer Ichiban, as we say in the home islands, but L.A. is. I doubt it. I think that the age of the center, of the one center, the sort of hegemonic city, is over. The Madrid, the London, the Paris, the New York, even the Tokyo. I don't think that's very likely. I think we're very much entering a world of many centers. So I don't think New York is over. There are lots of reasons, if you want to speak in materialist terms, why New York shouldn't be over. For example, if you want to write books, not movie scripts, but books, it's probably better to stay as far away as possible from a place where a $30,000 advance seems like peanuts, i.e. stay away from Los Angeles, because the temptation, since you don't get paid very much money for writing books, and you do get paid a lot of money for writing scripts if you manage to sell them, the temptation to be shooting for a script in a place where you're bound to run into people who write scripts is very high. Similarly, I think that for all the astonishing cultural enrichment of Los Angeles, both official and unofficial, both sort of sanctioned and countercultural, of the last 20 years, in particular, I suspect of the last 10, I don't know that the sorts of high cultural expressions are going to be as easy to maintain here as people may imagine. I can see that painting will, because painting is worth a lot of money. But, I mean, will the world of things that don't make money, the world, say, of, I don't know, Joseph Brodsky and Seamus Heaney and Derek Walcott, be really something people will value here? It would seem to me in an age of multiculturalism, particularly where the official ideology is of the Pacific Rim, and a sort of that those sorts of cultural artifacts may be rather less than more valued here.
It's an interesting thing. It's open to question. I think it's just beginning. I guess this is to some extent an enthusiastic anticipation of Los Angeles for the next year. I know that the Getty Foundation has just paid William Gass to live here and complete this long-awaited 20 years in the making novel, The Tunnel. I think that Los Angeles, for the first time, and warily and with great fear, trepidation, is preparing to meet head-on that strange difficulty it's had in relation to so-called high culture. It has been able to live without it, although, of course, as is also well known, it seems to be the place that the Schoenbergs and the Mons have chosen somehow to hide out. It is a very odd moment culturally for the city.
Well, it is an odd moment because it's obviously many different kinds of fractures and conjunctures are taking place here. I think it's true, of course, that Mann and Adorno and a lot of other people were very interested in L.A., and Mann loved his time on San Remo. He thought it was wonderful. He, though, was, as my mother once put it, a god in exile, and he did go back, after all. And I think that it's worth noting that Los Angeles has had one other great high cultural moment, and that was the Hitler period, when this was one of the most exciting cities in terms of the highest expression of European culture ever existed. Half of Weimar was here. That, in that sense, certainly the L.A. County Museum decadent art show, or rather some of the apparatus around the show itself, was very revealing. I hadn't realized myself how many people were in L.A. between 33 and the late 40s. I think it's perfectly possible. I suppose, though, that it may be a family trait, but my book is in part an argument against metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And what worries me is that Los Angeles, perhaps more than any other American city, has metaphorized its condition repeatedly.
I'm speaking to David Reif, the author most recently of Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World, published by Simon & Schuster. In order to avoid being insufferably kittenish, I suppose we had better name your mother, if you don't mind.
Yes, this is not something that in most of my interviews here ever do. My mother is Susan Sontag, and obviously, you know, writing is the family olive oil business. I also think my own, if I'm speaking biographically, my own interest in American cities probably also has a fairly simple-minded biographical origin, which is simply it is one interest I could probably carve out for myself. Mm-hmm. I mean, although, in fact, it's my mother who grew up in the Southwest and went to North Hollywood High School and all the rest of it, not me, and my grandmother, who was born in Boyle Heights, and I'm the Easterner in the gang, it is nonetheless the case that the kinds of subject matter that I started to write about fairly early on were very American, very much not about questions of European high culture, much in a different register. And I'm sure that I did that in part because I wanted to carve out some space for myself. That said, I'm now about to write a book about Europe, although about immigrant Europe. So perhaps
immigrant Europe in America, or
no, immigrant Europe in Europe, about the movement of, about the unsettling of Europe in some way by, I'm calling it in my head. One never knows. Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World, was a title I had from the beginning. The title I have for this book is called The Invention of the Blonde Third World. And it's about Eastern Europe after communism, but we'll see. We'll see. But you see, my own sense of what the writer's vocation is simply to do something original, to do something hard. I have no doubt that lots of claims that I make are over the top. That's the point. But and that unsettles people and pisses people off. But the fact of the matter is, that's the only stuff that I think is memorable. It's certainly the only stuff I read. Others will have to judge whether I live up to these standards I set for myself. But certainly, that's what I'm trying to do. As the late Don Bartholby said, you know, art isn't difficult because artists want to make it difficult. It's difficult because it's nature. It's not some perversity. It's its essence. And so, of course, you know, to write this very impressionistic book, kind of meditation on things, is a crazy high wire act. But it seemed to me the only trip worth making. Certainly the only trip worth making for an outsider. There are many locals' books worth writing about Los Angeles.
Well, another Barthelme term, defamiliarization, seems to be the first step in reconsidering anything.
Well, that's why in my view, it's obviously self-interested, but still, the outsider has a privileged position rather than a disabled position. You see, I think the person coming to a strange place finds it strange and therefore is halfway there already. And since I do think Barthelme's injunction, or, you know, I suppose he gets it from Jacobson and all of that, you know, is just right to me. It's all about saying, make it strange, which means make it over again, make it new. That's certainly my purpose. It's also the pleasure of it, the pleasure of doing it, the pleasure of making the text, and I hope of reading it.
Well, I think always of D.H. Lawrence, whose travel notes always begin with his arrival in enormous frustration and hatred. He sits down to his desk, and practically the first sentence is, "The reason I hate this place is..." And I think it's because, you know, the self does not want to be comfortable. You know, writing is a protracted discomfort.
Writing is horribly uncomfortable, physically, emotionally, morally. Physically, you smell and your back hurts. Morally, you're a predator. And Joan Didion's great phrase, don't trust the writer, she's always selling someone out. And emotionally, it drives you crazy. So indeed, discomfort would seem to be the mot d'ordre of the writer from the beginning. And of course, those great Lawrence books are models of a kind of dyspeptic travel writing of genius.
I've been talking to David Reith, the author most recently of Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World, published by Simon & Schuster, author as well of Going to Miami. Thank you for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
You can go in books to the land of ices, go in books.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.